Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 136, recorded January 20th, 2014. Big Bang Disruption. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get very interesting, very smart people on to try to explain this brave new world of ours. We've got somebody today, research fellow at Accenture, Larry Downes. He has written, this is kind of a trilogy, the third in the trilogy, Big Bang Disruption. He's joining us now in studio, which is very nice. Nice to see you, Larry.
Thank Pleasure. You for coming. Thank you for having me.
You probably hear him all the time on This Week in Law, where he's like a regular.
Semi-regular.
When you're on This Week in Law, do you talk about business or do you talk about law?
No, we talk about law. I mean, we talk about policy and law, and that's a big part, actually, of the research we're doing, too. So it fits in with this book, but it was definitely something in my last book was completely about.
The killer app.
No, the laws of disruption.
Laws of disruption. Yeah, okay, now I'm out of order. So Unleashing the Killer App was the first in the trilogy. Unleashing the Disruption? No.
No, Laws of Disruption.
Laws of Disruption was the second, and then this is the third. And have they all been informed by your research at Accenture, or?
No, this book was. This is the first time I've worked with Accenture, and it was because it was such a big research project. And I've also known, I started my career, actually, at Accenture 10,000 years ago. So I've known them for a long time. Right. And my co-author, his last book, so he has his own trilogy, and his last book was Jumping the S-Curve, and it was very much along these lines.
Right.
So we put our sort of two heads together, and we said, we think we have an idea here. But that was 2 years ago. We've been working on it for a long time.
I mean, what's really clear is that business has changed radically by the Internet.
Yes. I mean, we've knew that, 15 years
ago.
That's
obvious.
But the way in which it changes keeps changing itself.
Right. And that's what I found very interesting in this book is that, we've gone beyond the innovator's dilemma. Now, as somebody said, the innovator's nightmare.
Yes.
It was obvious 15 years ago the Internet was going to change things. Maybe it wasn't it's going to put realtors out of business. It actually didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we didn't completely understand how it was going to change things. And then the Clue Train Manifesto came along about 11 or 12 years ago and said, well, one thing is going to change is consumers.
That's right.
And how they interact with brands, how they interact with businesses. And that was right on. I think that's true. The Internet has empowered consumers. So that's become a big issue for companies. So this book is intended not so much for disruptors, although apparently disruptors like it. You've got DeCostello in the back saying, this is a great book, CEO of Twitter. But really for people who are about to be disrupted.
Well, which, of course, by the way, includes, today's startup is tomorrow's incumbent. It doesn't take very long.
You look at Microsoft and you go, they've been disrupted by the tablets.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. I mean, has the business cycle sped up?
Exactly. Yeah. The economist Joseph Schumpeter, he's the one who talked in the 1850s about the idea that capitalism is these perennial gales of creative destruction, that new technologies in particular drive reinvention of industries. It's a destructive process, but it's a creative process. He's absolutely right. And one way of thinking about what's happened in the last 10 years in particular is it's kind of creative destruction on steroids. Because now the cycles are much shorter, the disruptions are much more devastating in some ways. But also, of course, the upside is the opportunities are even bigger than they were. And, that's the part we like to talk about.
If one can but spot them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned not just Schumpeter, but Peter Drucker, another guy, a business writer who kind of sensed that this was, we were in a revolution.
Yeah.
Thomas Kuhn, who discovered the scientific paradigm shifts. And so, and this is all 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
Yeah, we had a lot of heroes, a lot of people whose work we really admire. And particularly, Drucker was the one who said information was effectively the currency of the future.
Right.
That expertise and knowledge workers, that's all Peter Drucker's work.
That was actually quite brilliant.
He was way ahead.
In the 70s.
Yeah. Right?
So what is different today in the 2010s?
So, I mean, what really started off the research was the recognition that there was something kind of fundamentally changing about the way in which new innovations were entering the market and doing their devastating thing. And what we realized was, we'd had enough generations of what we call exponential technologies, so technologies like computers that get faster and better and cheaper and use less energy, at a kind of predictably accelerating pace. So, you know, Moore's law and everything that goes with that. And by the way, it's not just in computers. We see it also in things like LEDs. We see it in materials science. We see it in the human genome. And a lot of technologies that are coming along that seem to be behaving in that kind of exponential fashion. So you get enough generations of that kind of exponential growth, and you see total different ways in which people interact. So one of the things we noticed was, in the old days, you mentioned Clayton Christensen's work and the idea of the innovator's dilemma. He said that the way, in his big insight, was that the way new technologies enter the market is they usually show up first as products or services that are cheaper but not as good.
Right. So people go in at the low end. Instead of actually, there was a time when it was people skimming off the top, but
that's right.
Now they skim. They say, you give as an example what the Bobcat, the little mini bulldozers.
Yeah, that was his. Actually, that was his example.
Yeah, they had a hydraulic technology that wasn't mature. Mm-hmm. That in fact did not work in a big construction site. So what do? They made little suburban cellar diggers.
Right.
Kind of captured that market, developed, and eventually took over.
Yeah. And his insight was, you know, when you see them entering at the low end, usually the incumbents say, well, I don't care. This is a market either I'm not in,
no money,
or they're not my customers.
Right.
And he said, no, that's when you have to start worrying. Because that's when you have to realize, well, they're going to mature, and eventually they're going to pass you in price and performance.
Right.
And he said, that's when you have to start your skunk works. That's when you have to start figuring out how you're going to make this very large transition, which, you know, many incumbents just can't do.
Well, it's very challenging. Because you risk your incumbency. You risk your existing business. Jeff Bezos famously said, I'm not worried about Barnes & Noble. They're never going to put their best people on the internet because they've got to maintain bookstores.
Yep.
They can't undermine their existing business.
Same with Blockbuster. That was another classic.
Bye-bye Blockbuster.
Why couldn't they do exactly what
they knew what was
Netflix
coming.
Is doing? But our observation was it's even worse than that. Because what we found is that now, thanks to this, you know, generations of exponential technology, when the innovation arrives, it's not just cheaper but worse. It's better and cheaper
at
the same
time.
So when it shows up, it's, you know, it's Google Navigation. That was sort of one of our examples. Google Navigation for Android, it's better, it's cheaper, it's more convenient than your TomTom or your Garmin or your Magellan standalone device.
And that happened in 3 years.
And when it arrived in the market,
boom,
that was it. Right?
It's all over.
And if you were waiting to see when, well, you know, it's going to come in, it's going to be inferior, it's going to be,
right.
We got plenty
of
time.
We can do a skunk works.
Yeah, no time, right? When it came in, within months, it had millions of users because, you know, one of the great things about this technology also is that the consumers, they know now when something is better and cheaper, they can tell each other through social media. As you were saying, you know, branding is now much more in their control. And adoption is much more at their pace. So when they like it, they're like, well, let's see. This is better and cheaper. This is worse and more expensive. Which one am I going to...
It's a no-brainer.
And their switching costs are negligible.
That's also a big shift, isn't it? We don't have brand loyalty in the way we used to. It's very easy. You think of Google as being dominant in search, but if a better search engine came along tomorrow... Simple thing to do to switch over to something else.
Well, you know, you may not be as old as I am, but, you know, I remember when I was using AltaVista, and
I remember when I was using Yahoo,
and I remember when I had lots of favorite search engines.
MySpace to Facebook.
Yep.
That stuff happens very quickly. And so if you're Mark Zuckerberg, you don't think of yourself as an entrenched incumbent. You think of yourself as the innovator.
Well, you actually hope that he does. I mean, I think, you know, Google in particular is very good about this, right? They never rest on their laurels for very long, at least. They're always thinking, all right, we're not in the search business. We're in the information business. So that may turn into Google Glass. That may turn into driverless cars. That may turn into alternative energy. Mm-hmm. They're sort of all over the place because they know, as you say, you know, just because you're everybody's favorite search engine today, that's not sustainable for any long period of time, or at least you don't want to rely on that.
Right, right. Do you build barriers to entry, or do you get aggressive and do your own innovation?
Well, you do both. All right, so, you know, one of the things that incumbents are quite good at is barriers to innovation, and one of their principal weapons, as we talk about in the book, is the patent system.
It's being used heavily.
And,
right,
you know, we don't condone necessarily this behavior because a lot of it we think is counterproductive. It's not really beneficial, but it's there, and it's a great weapon. And believe, you know, as you know, people use it as much as they can.
Well, again, to use Jeff Bezos as an example, the one-click patent, Jeff himself does not like the patent system, but you better be sure he enforced the one-click patent against Barnes & Noble.
That's right.
He knew that that was a tool he could use to keep people out of his business.
And that patent, by the way, was ultimately rejected.
Right.
But it didn't matter because all he needed was a year,
gave him some breathing space.
Actually a few months where he could get an injunction
yep.
to say, you can't do one click. And, you know, that couple months of that injunction over Christmas season at that kind of tipping point for electronic commerce, that was worth its weight in gold.
That's another thing the speed up has changed.
Yeah.
The barriers don't have to be giant walls. They could just be a little speed bump.
Mm-hmm.
That might be enough.
That might be enough.
So that, and then innovating. You're saying Skunk Works. You say that an incumbent can become an innovator.
Yes. Well, they are, you know, so, you know, of course, that was, you know, when Christian talked about the innovator's dilemma, he was talking about the incumbents as innovators. He's saying their dilemma as innovators
right.
is they can't
they
get out of their own. They can't
they,
get out of their own way.
Right.
And there's a lot of reasons they can't.
Right.
But one of the amazing things about, again, from our research, this exponential technology has done, it is has changed dramatically the economics of experimentation.
That's really important, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So it used to be, again, you think about where was the advantage? You had, you know, you had internal R&D, very proprietary, very secretive, lots of money. Of course, this is still the case in things like pharmaceuticals and things like that. But for software, and even many cases now for hardware, particularly for electronics and sensors and all this other stuff, the price point is so low, the cloud is there, the environment is there, the users are there, you don't have to do that anymore. You can experiment by simply kind of putting together a bunch of components, maybe some software, maybe some hardware, maybe an interesting business model, and you just let it go. You have a Kickstarter, an Indiegogo project. The users are actually funding you in this case. They become your biggest allies. And you just experiment literally in the market at an incredibly low cost and very low risk. If it takes off, you get this, you know, kind of vertical success. You know, you become Google, you become YouTube, you become Facebook. If it fails, usually it fails pretty quickly, and you don't waste that much time or that much money doing it.
That's where fail fast comes from.
Yeah.
If you're going to fail, you want to fail. You don't want to drag it out. You want to fail and move to the next thing and the next thing and the next
Try
thing.
Another combination.
Because it's cheap.
Yeah.
There's no barrier to doing that.
So that's really messed up things for incumbents because
yeah.
suddenly their biggest advantage.
Because what they had was capital.
Yeah.
What they had was 1,000 employees or 10,000 employees. Doesn't matter anymore. There's a guy, you know, there's two frat brothers at Stanford who just wrote Snapchat. Yeah. Sorry, Facebook. With all your programmers, you couldn't compete.
But the incumbents can get in on this game, and we've seen a lot of it. We talk about this, but we went to in the course of our research, for example, we went to lots and lots of sponsored hackathons, where companies.
That's what Facebook does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
They do
not just Facebook. AT&T,
yeah.
Citibank, all these
yeah.
big companies realize that there's a lot of kind of intellectual capital out there, especially with young people, maybe still in school, they're entrepreneurs and so on, that they don't have internally. They don't really want to hire them. They can't hire them in many cases. But that they can tap into that by, kind of sponsoring the kind of experimentation. And if it looks good, then they've got incubators where they can bring them in-house. So, for example, down in Palo Alto, AT&T has what they call the Foundry. And when they do their hackathons, if they find really interesting potential products, they'll bring those people inside. You know, they'll kind of co-develop with them and then bring it into market as quickly as they can. So they can get access to this low-cost experimentation without actually having to change their culture all that dramatically.
So that's interesting because I do feel like culture is such a big part of this.
Yeah.
And if I'm, is AT&T able to do something as freeform and as anarchic as a hackathon and successfully?
Yes.
It does work.
They do, several of them a month around not just around the country, but actually around the world.
That seems like a big change that these entrenched companies are actually able to be this nimble.
Yeah. Well, the ones that are going to survive,
right.
That's what's happened.
We were talking before the show about Kodak. Here was a company, saw the train coming down the tunnel, knew digital was coming, knew what a problem was ahead. They acquired an online site, Ofoto.
Yep.
They started building digital cameras. They recognized all this, and yet they still failed. They had patents galore. They had every asset. What did they do wrong?
Well, so it's very hard, to name one thing, but I think what was clear was that their DNA was so entwined with the idea of film photography and chemical-based development. You know, that was, they invented it. They were the leaders of it. They were the best-known, one of the best-known brands in the world for decades.
Right.
And they just culturally could not commit fully to the digital future, even though, as you say, they had by far some of the best digital photography patents. It wasn't like they were denying it. It wasn't like they
invented it in many cases.
That's right. And they just couldn't get there fast enough because they were, this was the innovator's limit. They were held back by their success as an incumbent.
Right. So why, okay, is, but that's why I say, how can AT&T do this?
Yeah.
What does it take for a company to have the, I mean, if there seems like there's a more conservative company than AT&T, and I don't know what it would be.
Well, it would be Citibank, for example. It's another one of the companies we write about. They're doing the same thing.
They are.
Yeah, they have an entire innovation lab also down in Palo Alto. They're also investing very heavily in, sort of startups and new people. They're getting involved in corporate venture capital in a very smart way, not in just kind of the throw money around way. And, I think what we found is what distinguishes the incumbents that can do it from the ones that can't is their ability to listen to reality, right? Because
the bitter truth.
Yeah, the hard truth.
The hard truth.
The truth tellers, as we say.
Yeah, that's the term you give them.
Yeah, the term comes from soap operas where you've got always one character
somebody
whose job it is to kind of tell the other characters.
Lupita, you are carrying his baby,
exactly,
but he does not love you.
Yes, that is your son. That is, he is not your brother. And those people are out there. Many of them are not employees. They're maybe young people.
Many of them get fired right away.
They're terrible employees in some of our examples. They're not very good employees. But if you can listen to them, they will tell you, hey, this industry is about to go down a very different direction. You've got to start the process of change or else you're not going to be here much longer.
You call them the canaries in the coal mine of your industry. But I have to say, I think it's still hard for incumbents like it was for Barnes & Noble because they don't want to cannibalize their existing business. Their entire revenue stream comes from the existing business. It's got to be so hard to say, well, I'm going to do something that could completely undermine my brick-and-mortar stores, for
example. Right.
Well,
especially if you're a public company because your shareholders, the Wall Street analysts...
They don't have any vision. They want the quarterly results.
One bad quarter, and they're going to, knock you out. It is difficult for them. But, what we found was that in many cases, obviously in certain industries, consumer electronics, computers, gaming, consumer products, they're long-standing reputation is they're incredibly competitive businesses, cutthroat businesses. You cut bait very quickly if a product isn't going anywhere. Those industries have much easier time adapting to this pace.
Right.
For Citibank, I think it was, when did they start all this innovation? Well, it was during the financial crisis. They were in terrible shape, and they said kind of, what else have we got? We got nothing to lose.
That was a good thing. They had nothing to lose.
for that aspect of it, yes. Obviously, they were liberated in some sense by saying,
can't get any worse,
can't
guys.
Can't get any worse than this.
This is great. We're talking to Larry Downs. He's the author of a new book, Big Bang Disruption. I'm calling it the third in a trilogy. I don't know if you or your publisher wants to think of it that way. But the reason you have to write new books all the time is because this whole thing is evolving as fast as is the internet and everything else that we're talking about.
Yeah,
you can find out more on the website BigBangDisruption.com. So this is in the chapter The Singularity. You say listen to these are the rules for companies that are facing this imminent demise, basically, the innovator's dilemma. So consult your truth tellers. Then you say pinpoint your market entry. What does that mean?
Well, so there's a lot of timing issues, right? And the example I think we give here is the Kindle. We had a generation, 10 years worth of failed efforts at providing e-book readers. And it wasn't that Amazon invented this technology. It wasn't that they figured out before anybody else, e-books could work. What they did successfully was to figure out when the right time was, when the e-ink was going to be at a good price point, when the processor were going to be faster and cheaper and available to do this, and when they could put together the network that they put together for delivering the content, keeping your library and all of a sudden, and tying it to the digital content that they already had. So they figured out, more than anything else, what was the right time to do an e-book reader.
This is hard to do, because you may not even know what you need before you develop it. And I think of so many counterexamples. Microsoft in 2001 said the tablet was going to be the revolution.
Well, Apple had done it even before that.
Apple had Newton.
The Newton, exactly.
So it wasn't they were wrong. It was their timing was wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly how you can know what you're going to need before you need it. This is where Amazon really has some genius, I think.
Well, a lot of it, yes, that's right. And, of course, it's hard to do this, but it's not impossible.
Right.
You have to obviously keep your nose to the the tracks to hear, I think your ears to the tracks,
right?
To hear as new technologies are being developed, and you have to be looking in non-traditional places. Again, if you're just looking at your own internal R&D, you're going to miss stuff that's happening, you know, in Amazon's case at the MIT Media Lab, where e-ink was being developed.
Right.
We talk about another
You'd think
example.
Every big corporation would have a spy at the Media Lab.
Well, the problem is, of course, there's lots of Media Labs. It's not just the Media Lab. Right. You know, you have to have them in
Xerox
Israel.
Park
and you have to have them all over
it's
the
endless.
World. In
yeah.
Russia now, in Korea.
Yeah. Right.
There's so many...
That's an even larger challenge. It's so global now. And you have to think that some of the biggest innovators are going to be coming out of Asia. They're going to be coming out of, as you say, Russia.
Yes.
China, who knows what's going on inside there?
Well, some people do.
Yeah, the smart ones do.
Yeah.
They're paying attention.
They are paying attention.
Then that may explain why so many companies like Apple and Google want to be in China. It may not just because, as we often think, well, it's a billion new consumers. It's also where innovation may be happening in ways that you've got to pay attention to.
You know, I think one of the things we're finding with the Google's, again, another Google example is their you know, gigabit internet experiments now in Kansas City. And Kansas City, what a coincidence. Kansas City is now becoming a hub of innovation.
It's like, oh,
well,
really?
Why? Well, because there's gigabit internet. And one of the things that you find is that if you've got high-speed networks, if you've got, you know, access to the internet and that kind of tools to work with, it doesn't really, you know, the sort of, there's still, I just was at an event some months ago, we were talking about the future of Silicon Valley and was there a future for Silicon Valley? Well, of course, there's a lot to be said. It's much more than that that makes Silicon Valley Silicon Valley. But it does get easier for other locations to tap into the same kind of tools, the same kind of resources. You know, if you have ultra-high-speed internet connection, that's a big piece of it.
Rule 3, I love this. Maybe this is what Google's gigabit Ethernet or gigabit internet project is: launch seemingly random market experiments.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, again, I was just in New York last week, and it looks to me now that, like, the city, you know, the borough of Brooklyn is basically nothing but people launching technology companies.
It's amazing.
It's food, it's clothing, it's hardware, it's software, it's games, it's political stuff,
right.
It's everything.
Right.
And again, how can they do it? Well, really, all they need is, you know, access to one of these crowdfunding platforms and these reusable components, reusable hardware components, reusable software components, in many cases, all they need. They put this together and they launch it and they see what happens.
Right.
They may not even have a business plan. We talk about a lot of examples of people who weren't actually trying to start a business. They were trying to prove a point about art history. They were trying to, recover the idea of artisanal beer or artisanal gin. And making money was kind of secondary
right.
to them. It was really that they had this belief, I hate to use the word, but they had a passion for something that they wanted to do. Now they have the ability to kind of find out if there is a market for it. And
right.
if there is, they can grit that market, you know, wherever those people are all over the world, they can get access to those people very quickly and very cheaply, either as customers or as funders or in many cases as both, and launch these experiments, which, you know, for them, this is a fun thing to do. But if you're the incumbent, like, wait, where did this come from? It comes completely out of left field.
Anheuser-Busch, you could acquire as many artisanal beer manufacturers as you want, but that doesn't necessarily transform your business.
Right.
It strikes me that all of this is because of the friction-free nature of this new digital world. Money is easy to raise. Customers are easy to find. New customers are easy to find because people are not loyal.
Yeah.
There's no friction.
And parts are, you know, it's easy to find the sourcing and the manufacturing. And
easy to
distribution.
Make. Easy. Everything's gotten easy. Well, what that means is the thing, as you said, the inherent advantages of being a big incumbent, a big business, have evaporated.
So that goes back. And that, I don't know about the trilogy, Leo, but this does go back to my first book.
The Killer App.
Book.
Yeah.
We talked there about this idea, you know, coming from the great, now recently deceased economist Ronald Coase, who said, you know, the idea of what makes firms exist at all is that markets have friction, markets have inefficiency, and that the way you get big companies is the bigger the company is, it means the more inefficient the market is. So that's why you had GM.
Oh, that's fascinating.
For example, he said, look, you know, the amount of complexity of building a car and distributing the car and financing the car, if you were trying to just do that as a series of market transactions, it would be very expensive. If you internalize it, you know, there are certain costs associated with internalizing it, but you're going to reduce all that friction. And what we said in Killer App was, it's reversing. Now, the internet is now making the market more efficient more quickly, than businesses. They're both using the same technology, but the market is adapting that technology much more quickly. So, you know, the internet, it was obviously, you know, consumers were using it before businesses were.
Right.
And so the market was developing these efficiencies much more quickly than businesses were. And that was kind of flipping the economics of it. And in that sense, what we're saying here is that has not stopped.
No, no. It's accelerated, in fact.
It's accelerated.
And yet you see big companies like Google. Is that no longer a reflection of market inefficiencies? How does Google get big? What makes Google big if a million little Googles can exist all over the place?
Well,
there are some inefficiencies.
Yes, there are.
Crawling the internet is an inefficiency, isn't it?
Yes, there's still, you know, there are still, you know, and there probably will never be zero, you know, friction. Even Coase said the idea of a friction-free economy was a dream.
We're a lot closer to that dream than he thought, probably.
yes. But there are still, obviously, yes, advantages to size. And for,
yes,
I think in Google's case, and a lot of tech companies' case, it's that they have access to a bigger pool of information that they can slice and
That's
dice
right.
and do stuff with and turn into new products.
And they've recognized that.
And they know that. Yeah, they built the business not around a product, search, right? They built the business around the idea of get as much information as we can. We'll figure out what we're going to do with it. But the core product is not search.
It's kind of like the NSA.
Well,
collect all the information you can. We'll figure out what to do with it later.
Yes, there's a legal version of it and a not-so-legal version of it.
But you know what? There's a real parallel between information gathering by the government and information gathering by private industry. They both see the huge value in big data, mm-hmm, and they saw it 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And now they are truly incumbents because there's a real barrier to entry.
Yeah.
And when Google buys a company like Nest, you could say it's about design or it's about algorithms, but really it may just be about data.
Mm-hmm.
How interesting. And they recognize that. That's also an important factor.
Yeah, they are the ultimate, I think, example of people who are not afraid of the truth, even
right,
if the truth is very painful.
Right.
They're going to listen.
Are there truth tellers inside Google who are telling Larry?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know,
he's your son, Lupita.
We don't have we don't have access inside.
We don't know who it is.
We know a lot of the people. We talk to a lot of people. We spend a lot of time looking at some of these projects, and it's clear that, you know, there's a much more open environment for telling the truth there than, say, you know, historically someplace like Microsoft.
Well, that's it. What would your advice be to Microsoft? They're at a very difficult juncture right now, not merely finding a CEO, but really reinventing their business.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, I think they've had a hard time. Obviously, they've had many successes. Xbox One was launched. It seems to have been a great success.
So if you look at what their success was, and I've been thinking a lot about this, it was very clear. And it was, we owe them a lot. They created a platform. In the 80s and 90s, they created a common platform. And that's, frankly, why you saw this application development, software development, because you could write to a platform. It was a solid, stable platform. You knew what you were going to get. Microsoft made it. Everybody used it. That was dominant. And I guess you could say, you know, Google looked at that and that's why they have Android. I mean, the idea of platforms hasn't gone away.
No.
But what if now you have a platform instead of the platform?
Yeah.
Where do you go?
Well, you want to, so I think, you know, for them, again, I'm not giving them advice because they're not asking for it, but.
Well, give them advice because they need it.
Well, I think, you know, for them.
Then they should go to Accenture and hire you, somebody. You
it's,
know, but.
I think it's also similar with big tech companies like IBM before that is.
Same
instead,
thing.
And it goes back to your, frankly, to your example of Kodak, is if you're organized around a product or a particular
yes.
technology, then you kind of filter out anything that doesn't fit that model. If you're organized, let's say Google, let's say Yahoo, let's say YouTube, if you're organized around information, if you're building it around information and you say that's the product,
right.
everything that comes out of it, whether it's an Xbox, whether it's Windows, whether it's, you know, whatever the product is that comes out, whether it's hardware in the case of, you know, why did Google buy Motorola?
Right.
Whatever it is, if it's all feeding this this information engine, then you're doing the right thing. If you're very siloed, if you look at a company, I think it's a good indicator of whether an incumbent is gotten the right track or they're on the wrong track, is how siloed are they?
Microsoft's highly siloed.
Well, so this I think organizationally could be the one best piece of advice I could give.
Yeah, get out of the silos and rethink what your business is, because moving to devices and services is just saying, oh, we got a new product, a new platform. It's not rethink. The old truism is that the railroads went out of business because they thought they were in the railroad business. They didn't understand they were in the transportation business.
Well, they also went out of business because they overbuilt and they had the Interstate Commerce
It was a classic boom bust cycle, wasn't it? We'd see those over and over again.
Yeah, in other countries, that didn't happen. So clearly, you know, it was, as you say, it wasn't the technology that was at fault.
Right.
It wasn't like railroads became irrelevant.
Right.
But the model for how to use them changed, and they right. didn't change fast enough.
Yeah. So you talk about these stages, and I mentioned the singularity. That's what comes before the Big Bang. Mm. I should ask you this first. What is the Big Bang?
So the Big Bang is what we refer to as the moment when a innovation enters the market, both better and cheaper than the things it's going to compete with.
I'm out of business.
Too late. Yeah. If you haven't responded
too
yet,
late.
If you don't have a plan in place by then, if you haven't been watching those failed early market experiments, you haven't been watching the 10 years of ebook readers that didn't take off, if you looked at them, in fact, and said, oh, look, it's not ready for prime time. Nobody
yeah.
wants
ha,
this.
Ha,
what
no.
we're doing is clearly right. If that's what you've done, then at that moment when the Kindle shows up, if that's when you say, oh, now it's here, let's start responding,
yeah.
then it's too late.
That's when the big crunch hits.
Well, the big crunch comes later. That's the next stage.
Okay.
That's after, we'll stick with the Kindle, for example. So you got the Kindle, and it takes off. And you got some other platforms that look like that. But you suddenly get market saturation in a very short period of time, right? Everyone who's going to, not everyone, but
I think that's happened for the iPad.
Vast majority,
is a good example.
The vast majority who are going to buy that
right.
have bought it. Okay, so now what happens? Well, in the olden days, you had lots of time to kind of milk the market and get these late adopters, get the laggards, as they used to be called.
There are no laggards.
They're not there anymore. Right? So once the Big Bang hits,
we're all early adopters.
It's straight
now.
Up. It's, you know, we're Airbnb, we're Uber, everything is coming
yeah,
up roses.
But where are you going to go next?
Where are you going to go next? And that's what they do. Now, if you don't want to be a one-hit wonder, and some of these companies, as we've seen, have become one-hit wonders, then you got one of two choices. Either you're going to be Nest, you're going to be Snapchat, you're going to sell out quickly, right?
Right?
You're going
right.
to say, we had a great success.
Yep.
Rather
Cash
than
in.
Come out with another one,
yeah.
we're going to go into another company.
Yeah.
And that's one option. The other option, if you want to stick around, is where's your next innovation? And where's the innovation after that? And where's the one after that? And
right.
that's what, you know, Apple has been particularly good at.
It's where Facebook is right now. Facebook rode that Big Bang
yeah.
very clearly and completely dominated
yep.
and got a billion users. And, you know, when you're in that position, it's hard to say, okay, but what do we do next?
Yeah.
Andy Grove said, you got to be paranoid. He was
That's
the
right.
CEO of Intel. He says, you always got to be looking over your shoulder.
Only the paranoid survive.
Right.
Yeah.
That was the name
brilliant.
Of his book.
That right.
So if you're Mark Zuckerberg, I think he is paranoid, actually. I think he's very clearly aware that this is a moment in time and he's got to keep innovating. But is that what you do? You acquire companies?
One way to do it is to acquire. As I say, if you're not going to sell out, to another company.
If you're the big nobody can buy Facebook, so.
Not now.
That's not an option.
Yeah, well, maybe, you know, before
maybe
they
Maybe then, public. Yeah, right.
It's the same with Twitter. So
right.
if you can't be acquired, then you can acquire. And this, of course, has been a long-standing story. Cisco has been doing this for decades. It's, you know, the bulk
not
of
Not always successfully.
You know,
Linksys was a... Well, anyway, go on.
And, you know, Google does it, too.
Google,
They've
yep.
acquired lots of companies.
Yep.
Microsoft, not such
Apple
a big
Apple does not do that, which is interesting.
Yeah. Well, because then the alternative is, if you're not going to acquire... the innovators,
innovate within.
Then you better have a culture. And
yeah.
this is nothing new to Silicon Valley, right? You think about companies like 3M, you know, what was their business? It wasn't tape, it wasn't chemicals, they were in the business of innovating.
Yeah. They call it invention.
New products.
But it's the same idea, new products. We invent here.
That's what we do.
Yeah, yeah. So Facebook needs to invent.
They need to invent. Or acquire.
Easier said than done, I think.
Yeah. Well, they're on an acquisition spree, clearly,
right.
and that seems to be
right.
putting new blood into the system, because you don't just get the products of those people, right? You get the people.
That's those acquirers. They're not really about products. Maybe Nest isn't even about a product. Maybe
yeah.
Nest is about Tony Fadell and 100
Or maybe
Apple
just
guys.
A design philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. yeah. So you've survived. The singularity was your moment to notice, to experiment, to find the next big thing. The Big Bang happens. Let's hope you're riding that train. The big crunch is
when now the market is saturated and
there's no next
there's
act.
No there's no there's no new customers coming for this generation of
I
product.
Think of HDTV as an example. No, the television industry was completely caught off guard because in the past people bought TVs and they bought TV they didn't buy them only every 10 years, but they continually bought new TVs. All of a sudden, HDTVs, everybody bought one and that was it.
Yeah.
Nobody bought another one.
Well, they tried. Of course, they tried 3D.
A 3D.
And now, of course, I 4K. Just came back from the Consumer Electronics Show. And
is that what CES really is about, is all these people, these little experiments, these crazy experiments?
You know, CES is about so many things.
Right.
That's what I love about it.
That's a good point.
You've got the show floor where you have these enormous, you've got Samsung, you've got Sony, you've got all these enormous tech companies showing their next generation products. And that's really cool. But increasingly now, if you sort of walk around the margins, if you go to the suites at some of the other hotels, you will see, we saw last year, before anybody, it was a Kickstarter project, we saw Oculus Rift, which was the virtual reality gaming goggles. We saw a very early version of that in a suite at the Venetian Hotel. You know, the guys were sleeping in it and doing demos in it. They were really a true startup.
Yeah.
This year, they won the best of show for a prototype.
Right.
So
yeah,
there's a lot of that
product,
too.
Really?
No, they don't. No, they're the first ones to say it. They're still in prototype. So there's a lot of that at CES now too, and you can really kind of—it's nice to look at the contrast of saying, here's the big companies and what they're trying to do with innovation, but here's the edges. Here's people doing alternative energy, different kinds of battery technology, different kinds of power technology, different. Obviously, all the Internet of Things that people were talking about, all the wearable devices. A lot of those are in what we would think of as the singularity at that early experiment stage. And they're there, too.
I think as consumers, and probably true for CEOs in many companies, we don't have a great sense of scope, of history, of scale. We are in the moment. Mm. And somebody in the chat room is saying, Facebook and Twitter, they're established. There's nothing going to happen to them. And I'm sure that there are many CEOs who go, hey, how could we be any more powerful, more successful? We are king of the world, baby. And that's exactly when you have to worry.
That is the moment of risk, absolutely. That's when the crunch can come.
Somebody noting that Apple was building its billion-dollar campus, Amazon building its billion-dollar campus, said that's when you know a company's in trouble because they're at their peak. They're building their massive, pyramids. Right? And like Ozymandias, this might be it.
Well, or even when they were building the pyramids for, of course, they were built to be tombs.
Right. Well, so, good point. They're building their tombs.
Not what they're doing. Well, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think some of these companies can continue to be like 3M. They can be in the innovation business.
Well, and I think books like yours are this is becoming much more common wisdom. People understand that this is a false view of the world that we're on top and we will continue as it is forever is more so now than ever before. Absolutely not the case.
Yeah.
What would you do though if you're, let's say, a cable company? You've got a business challenge because your whole business is built on the copper that you've dug in the ground 30 years ago and selling premium content over that copper. All of a sudden, your customers are saying, I don't want the premium content. I can download it over your wholesale bits. Your business model is screwed up. And you pretty much, what business are you in?
Yeah.
You're in the, I dug a trench in the ground business. That's not a good, there's no future there. Are there businesses that just should say, well, yeah, it was nice?
No, well, there is still, I still know one.
I'd hate to be in the cable industry right now. You know what I'm saying?
I still know one store in London that does a thriving business in selling buggy whips. There's the only
one
store, but there's a thriving business. And we talk about that. We talk about companies that can continue to serve
what we call
legacy customers.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the case for cable. I mean, what? Let's take cable as an example. What did Comcast do? They went out and bought NBC Universal. They got into the content business. And they said, okay, you're right. The pipes may not be the way to make a profit long term, but if we can merge that and essentially go from being a thing company to being a service company... And we'll offer it however you want. Ultimately, is it going to be a la carte? Is it going to be over the internet? Is it going to be over the top? Is it going to be native?
Right.
It's going to be all of that.
Right.
And we don't, I don't think anybody could say right now, if you said, what do consumers want, in the television space? Well, first of all, it depends on who you're asking, which consumers. Some of them want this. They still like the bundles. They may like it all along. Again, those may be the legacy customers. You've got other people saying, no, I want to pick and choose. It's a lot of work to pick and choose. They want it from the internet. They want it on whatever device they're on. It's clear. The only thing I think that's clear about that industry is they're going to want more of everything.
Right.
And so from that standpoint, it's a great business to be in.
See? Is the ultimate truth teller your customer?
Not always, because customers can be wrong. Right? Customers, can think they know what they want, particularly if they're, as we just call them, legacy customers.
They don't want anything to change.
They don't want things to change.
I want my bundle. I want Starz, Cinemax, Showtime, and HBO, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I want to pay $150 a month.
So think about enterprises like the United States Postal Service. They are the ultimate legacy business.
Yeah.
They can't, literally, by law, they can't go out of business.
Right.
Even though, you know, on every conceivable measure and metric, their business has disappeared. Right? It's
right.
gone, you know, everything you want to measure. The first
right.
class, all down, 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 down.
Yeah.
And it keeps falling.
Yeah.
And there's no question that it's going to continue to fall.
Right.
Right? But, you know, the minute they go to Congress and say, we want to stop Saturday delivery, you know, we want to close post offices, we want to shut distribution centers. You have all these vested interests. You have sort of local interests. You have the unions. You have, you know, the congressmen who say, you know, not in my district, you're not
right.
going to do that.
Right.
Or, you know, you've got sort of
nostalgic
people who are saying, hey, we want mail on Saturday.
Yeah.
So it's very hard for them to literally to go out of business, even though, you know, they're
losing. And yet, somebody at the post office is smart and planning ahead and thinking about that. They did a deal with Amazon for Sunday deliveries.
Yeah.
So it is possible, even with the most entrenched legacy business of all, to think progressively and plan for the future.
And that is actually the other tragedy for the U.S. Postal Service. They cannot, by law, go into new businesses without the permission of Congress.
Oh,
so they,
that's
the,
bad.
The postmaster keeps, every year, there's a sort of
Please.
Annual ritual beating where the postmaster goes to Congress and says, we've lost another $300 million this year. You know, our pension obligations and our health care obligations are dragging us down very quickly. Please let us, you know, close these things. Please let us cut back. Please let us go into new businesses. And Congress never passes anything.
No. So survive catastrophic success. That's a company like Facebook, for instance.
Yeah.
Or, well, Google or 1,000 companies right now. Then capture winner-take-all markets. Why do you want a winner-takes-all market?
Well, so again, because of what we call this near-perfect market information, where consumers,
right.
when they like something, they will tell each other very quickly through social media, this is the winning product.
Is that going to happen in every business,
yes.
every market?
Yes.
Wow.
And it's, you know, certainly the case now in things like consumer electronics. So if you
right.
are selling the leading HD TV, you're the only one who can really charge a premium.
You're the one.
You're the one. Or in the smartphone. Right now, let's say, you know, it's Apple and Samsung.
Yeah.
Because consumers say, these are superior. Now, they may be only slightly superior.
But they may have
90%
of the market.
And they're the only ones who can charge a premium. Everyone else is pretty much, you know, offering commodity price. So if you are not perceived as the best in a crowded field, no profit.
Wow. That's kind of sad to me because it reduces diversity. Doesn't it?
Well, it does if you're imagining that the market is going to be stable. Of course, you know, those
the diversity is created by the revolutions.
By the technology
that are
saying,
happening.
Well, you know, yes, your Galaxy
you're
S4
number one,
phone,
but only today.
You know, we're going to look at that. We're going to make fun of it in 5 years and say, oh, remember that crazy.
5 years?
You know,
5 months?
That brick, that thing, you know, whatever it was.
That's why you have to create bullet time.
Yeah.
What is that?
So that's what we were talking before about, you know, kind of using the patent system, using the legal system to slow down the upstarts.
Okay.
Because a lot of times, of course, these experiments, you know, they don't quite always cross their T's and dot their I's on the law. They may be not really too careful about copyright. They may not be too careful about patent. And a lot of times, you know, industries can slow down or change the course of disruption by using the legal system. Great example of this is what's happening with things like Uber and Airbnb. Right, so the car
lots
rental
of regulatory
people,
issues.
And, you know, they don't like this. They don't
right.
like change, and they're because they've been regulated so long. They're way behind the curve in innovation.
Right.
You get in a taxi cab in any city, and you think, you know, why can't I dispatch and pay?
Back in 1950,
the GPS on my phone is better when they've got.
Yeah.
So they're way behind, and they don't like the idea that somebody can come in who not only is more innovative than them, but isn't under the regulation. And so what they're doing is trying, it's a short-term at best solution,
right.
but they are trying to use the taxi cab commissions, to use the public utility commissions, to use city councils to say, you need to ban these services, you need to force them to abide by our regulations, which often doesn't make much sense, but trying to slow them down through the very things that keep them uninnovative, which is the regulatory process.
But what this changes my point of view a little bit because it's not... I always thought of it, oh, it's reactionary. The music industry, they're just a bunch of guys in white pants and white shoes and smoking cigars, and they don't get it. It's not reactionary necessarily. It's just one of the tools. They may, in fact, be very forward-thinking. They may be planning the future. But meanwhile, they got to create bullet time for the other guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, you see this in the cable companies, you see it in content companies, you see it in taxi cab companies. You see it all over the place. But that doesn't mean they don't get it. It means they're using one of many tools that they have available.
Right. It doesn't mean they don't get it, although it doesn't mean they do get it either.
Right. Well, a lot of taxi times, cab, yeah. Probably not.
But. My, I've been writing about Uber for quite a while, and this has sort of put me into, let's say, contact with the Taxi Cab Limousine and Paratransit Association. I don't see a lot of innovating going on there.
So you get that sometimes, too. You get the guys who drive the horse-drawn carriages in New York City. They're not moving ahead. Anticipate saturation is rule 7. Yeah. What's that?
So this is just recognizing, again, when it's going to come that you will actually have reached...
No, ahead of time. The big crunch is coming.
It's coming.
Yeah.
And prepare
for it.
Because one of the things we found was, you know, the nice thing about catastrophic success is you don't necessarily have to be prepared for 100 million people showing up all at once because you can lease more space on a cloud server.
Right.
You can get...
Things are scalable.
You can scale. But at the same time as you scale up, you got to be careful to scale down. And we found a lot of companies, and a lot of examples, some in the gaming industry, where they kept thinking, oh, well, this is going to keep going up and up and up. And at the moment when the market got saturated, they were stuck with lots of inventory, too much infrastructure, too many employees. You know, basically, they thought, well, this is going to go on with this product forever. And
you know, if
caught.
They had just paid attention to history, that's happened in the gaming industry alone.
Of course.
Many times.
Every generation.
It started with Atari.
Yeah.
You use as an example of this the Hummer. General Motors was, this thing's selling great.
Yeah.
We'll be able to sell Hummers forever. Until 2005, when they had to declare bankruptcy.
Yeah. And at that point, you know, they had waited so long to get rid of the business that they couldn't even find a buyer for the asset.
So shed assets before... They become liabilities.
Exactly. And of course, there was a sad case there in the car business because, again, legally, they're required to keep an inventory of spare parts. They're required to offer long-term warranties.
Right.
And so, again, it's a case of, well, you can't get out of that business as quickly as the business is going to disappear. You're going to be stuck serving your legacy customers for quite a while to come.
Good example right now, you use Philips as an example, incandescent light bulbs. Now, you could have seen that coming. In Australia, they banned them a few years ago. You could see this train wreck coming.
Yeah.
Philips, did they react properly? They got into LEDs?
Philips was genius in this. There's equivalent in LEDs to Moore's Law. It's called Heitz's Law. And it says that, you know, so very similar to Moore's Law. It says that the performance of LEDs continues to improve exponentially on price and performance and energy usage. And they looked at this in the early 2000s. They said, all right, well, right now, the LEDs are completely unperforming. They don't compete with us at all.
Right.
But, you know, here's the way the line is moving. It's going like this. And incandescence, you know, flat. There's a point at which, you know, Heitz's law is going to intersect. And at some point in the future, they said, incandescents are going to be worse and more expensive than the better and cheaper LEDs. And so this was the genius moment. They said, let's cut our losses now. Let's announce... way before we have to, that we are getting out of the incandescent business. And by the way, you know, they were one of the inventors of it. They were certainly the market leader in it for 100 years.
Yeah.
It was a cash cow.
Since 1891.
And they said, we're getting out of that business. We are going to switch to LEDs and, you know, CFLs and other technologies, and we're going to do it as quickly as we can. And then they went to the governments, they went to the NGOs, and they said, and we think for as a matter of sustainability, everybody should do this.
How interesting.
And so they were instrumental in getting Australia, United States, United Kingdom, the EU, to set these deadlines for terminating the incandescent business, because they were already prepared.
And this is a way to win.
Yep.
Be the one.
Be ready.
That started in 2006, they made this decision.
Yes.
8 years ago.
And they started investing in LED companies. They realized that part of the LED business is going to be about the fixtures. So they started getting... You go today to a lot of high-end electronic stores and you see there's a Philips product called Hue.
I have a bunch of them.
Yeah, it's
love
great.
Love it.
Right? It's programmable in, you know, LEDs. You can change the color. You can change the mood.
Yeah.
They get it. This is a much richer technology than incandescence, which just kind of burned a lot of energy and gave off a lot of heat.
Right.
This is programmable.
This is actually a really good example because there are also companies like Cree. They're small, nimble companies trying to nip at their heels. But it sounds like Philips played this very well from way back when.
Yep.
And are they going to be the company that owns this?
Well,
sounds like it.
We don't know. But I think
They did the right.
As you say, they've played it very well, at least so far.
Wow.
That's the best you can hope
well
for.
Well played, sir.
Yeah.
Finally, entropy.
Yes.
What is that?
So this is the sad end of the life cycle of
heat
innovation.
Death.
You are stuck. You are the United States Postal Service. You can't get out of this business. You're the landline telephone companies. When everybody's cut the cord, you're still legally obliged to offer it to the five people left, you know, out in rural in Nebraska.
You really don't want to be there.
You don't want to be there because you can't operate at scale anymore.
Sounds like governmental interference is the number one reason people are there.
That was
regulation.
You know, our experience was, you know, I mean, you could make bad decisions and find yourself trapped.
Sure. Kodak.
But Kodak is one.
Yeah.
But oftentimes, yeah, it's because by law you are stuck. You have to offer long-term warranties. You
yeah.
have to stay, and you can't
Hummer
literally.
Parts.
You have to serve customers.
Yeah.
That's a bad thing. But we had a great example of a company that got out of that, and that was Texas Instruments, when the sort of their home computer business. Really went south, and this is, you know, way back in the 1980s. They got caught terribly. They got caught with huge inventory and huge infrastructure, and the market fell out from under them. They couldn't make money anymore, and it really for a while there it looked like the company was in serious trouble, and then they realized, well, what can we do? Is we can take not our product, but one of our pieces of our technology and use it elsewhere. So they had this fantastic toy called the Speak and Spell, and a lot of variations on that. And the core of that, the core technology,
was the TI-99 chip that had been taken out of
the DSP.
The DSP,
the digital
wow.
signal processor. They said this is just a workhorse chip
wow.
that can convert analog signals to digital signals. And they said there must be other markets for that.
Wow.
Rather than making consumer products ourselves, rather than making this stuff, let's become
Sell
a supplier.
Yeah.
Effectively, let's become an arms merchant.
Right.
In a war that we don't have to fight.
We don't have to fight it.
And so they went. They're now, of course, they've diversified since then. But for many years, they were the leading supplier of DSP chips to a wide variety of other industries. And that's really what brought them back and made them even stronger than before.
And wisely, they plowed some of those profits into R&D. And, of course, they came up with DLP chips, and
exactly.
they owned that market. Now that market's dead. I hope they have a fifth act or whatever. So entropy is something that potentially all companies face. And how do you can't avoid it. Can you innovate out of it?
Sure. I mean, you really only find yourself in the entropy if you've missed the big crunch.
Right.
If you didn't get out in time, you got stuck with assets, you got your assets turned into liabilities. If that happened to you, and all you've got left are these legacy customers who won't change or can't change or don't want to change because they're nostalgic, they're old-fashioned,
right.
you can scale down and survive. We have an example here. We talk about the pinball industry. It's one of our most detailed examples here. There is still one company left, Stern, that makes pinball machines. There were dozens of them.
It's a nice little business.
And it was a huge, it was huge. It made more money than the movie industry for
yeah,
many years.
Yeah.
Huge,
wow.
huge business. Yeah, it was multi-billion dollar
wow.
business. But it got killed.
Yeah.
And they all shut down. And only Stern was left. And now Stern makes a very nice business selling
yeah.
machines for
yeah.
home users,
yeah.
you know, nostalgic
yeah.
baby
it's like
boomers
Steinway.
Like me. Yeah.
There's a little niche.
It's a niche.
It's not so bad to be in a niche.
If you
Unless
listen,
you
if,
wanna,
if the profit margin is there and you're,
right.
you've scaled down appropriately,
right.
it's fine.
Well, you just described a complete business cycle. And you, the entrepreneur, get to choose where, where you want to pin your tail on that donkey. The book is Big Bang Disruption. Larry Downs, Paul Nunes is your co-author. He is a director of research at Accenture.
That's right.
And Accenture, you're a research fellow there. Accenture did a lot of the research for this book there. And I imagine that, you know, there's really no excuse if you're a CEO of a company at any stage in this not to understand what's going on.
That's right. And I must say, you know, we were amazed in a lot of the interviews we did with CEOs, and I'm not just talking about incumbent CEOs, but even CEOs of startup companies, or not startup, but tech companies. People should know better. And we said, well, you know, you should be paying attention to what's happening on Kickstarter and Indiegogo, because these people are playing around the edges.
Yeah.
I mean, you're interesting. How many of them said, what's Kickstarter?
Oh.
Like, okay, this is a problem.
Yeah.
Okay. Problem number one, you don't even know that this experimentation exists.
Yeah.
And that's a bad sign.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's no excuse for that.
There's no excuse. You could buy the book, Big Bang Disruption. It's on Amazon, everywhere books are. Is there an audio version of this? I hope soon.
Yes, there will be soon.
On Audible, because I want to listen. Very nice to meet you. Thanks for coming by, Larry Downs. And we'll see you back on This Week in Law.
I'll be back on in March.
Soon. And everybody should go out and buy the book. Thanks for being on Triangulation. It's nice to have an in-studio guest. Usually it's on Skype and it's dropping out. And talk about innovation. We need innovation in voice over internet. That's where we need some innovation. We do Triangulation now at a new time. I hope you will come in and watch live if you can. 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern time. That's 2100 UTC on Mondays. Mondays, 2100 UTC on twit.tv. But, you know, of course, if you can't get the show, can't be here at this time, you can always watch after the fact. We make on-demand audio and video available at twit.tv/TRI. It's on YouTube at youtube.com/triangulation. And you can always subscribe and get it downloaded every week on iTunes or wherever you get your netcasts. Thanks for joining us. And I don't know who's next week, but I'm sure it's going to be Carson Bondi, our producer, is doing such a bang-up job getting us guests. It's going to be somebody fascinating. Make sure you tune in for the conversation next week on Triangulation. Bye-bye.